Welcome to the Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Taha Lokhandwala, Deputy Personal Finance Editor at Investors Chronicle, and Jason Hollands, Managing Director at Tilney. Star manager Neil Woodford has built up a very strong reputation over 30 years, but over the last three calendar years, his largest fund, LF Woodford Equity Income, has underperformed. This has led to a number of investors pulling money out of the fund and brokers removing it from their buy lists. So in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle, we've set out the case for and against the fund. Taha, you set out the arguments for ditching LF Woodford Equity Income Fund. So what would be the main reasons for doing this?
Hi, Leonora. Yes, I did. So there's probably three parts to my argument. Firstly, starting with performance and stock picking. There's some issues around governance as well that I would like to, which I discuss, and a kind of change in infrastructure based on Neil now managing the funds from his own firm, having kind of a lower support amount of support than what he had at Invesco before he left. Just starting with performance. So over 3 years, the fund is down 7%. The FTSE All Share is up 34%. And the average for the Investment Association UK All Companies sector is 27%. So this isn't marginal underperformance we're talking about here. This is going in reverse. Since launch, it's worth mentioning this as well, because I will come on to how the performance split into two parts. Since launch, it's actually returned 11%, but this is still versus 33% for the FTSE All Share. So you can see some kind of material underperformance here.
Okay, so why has the fund underperformed?
And this is what I mean about kind of breaking it down. So if we look at the first 3 years of the fund, so it launched in June 2014. So the first 3 years, absolutely fantastic. Returned 38% versus 25% for the FTSE All Share. Now, since then, to date, the fund is down 20% versus 5% for the FTSE All Share. So again, you can see how, yes, the UK equities have struggled generally. We can see that with only 5% return over what is almost a kind of 2 year period, but the fund is down 20. And that is down to two things, which I've been trying to put my finger on. One is a change in strategy, which kind of was implemented post 2016, June 2016, when we had the EU referendum, well, membership of the EU referendum. And since then, and this has been a discussion we've had quite a lot on this podcast and in the magazine, UK equities, particularly the ones that have been facing the domestic economy, have looked very cheap. Now, Mr. Woodford has talked about this quite a lot. He's been very bullish on the UK economy. He's been very bullish on companies that face the UK economy and derive their returns from the UK economy. And he's been kind of changing the composition of his fund that was there from the launch in 2014 to now. And this was the kind of trigger point towards these kind of very cheap companies that face the UK economy. And examples are some of the house builders he added in Lloyds Banking Group and kind of things like that. Now, that's been fine. A lot of people have done that. A lot of people agree with his position that these companies are very undervalued. We've talked about this many times, and a lot of managers have done this. But there's been a lot of stock blow-ups as well. So individual company positions, big positions in his portfolio that he has made where the share prices have really struggled, or there's been a kind of corporate event that has led to a material fall in the share price. And that's kind of the second part as to what's really affected this performance.
Okay. And did any holdings in particular cause problems?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you, there's five or six we can go through, but I won't. I do mention these in the piece in the magazine, but we'll start with Provident Financial. So this is kind of a doorstep lender. Its share price fell like 75% within the space of a week. It was a 6% holding of the fund, so that's a huge impact there. Also, Capita was a 3.2% holding in the fund when its share price was trading close to kind of £10. It now trades at £1.20, but it's still a 1% holding. But it's waiting in the portfolio as a combination of the share price fall and also probably Mr. Woodford kind of revisiting his holding. Imperial Brands, a kind of stalwart of the fund, has been in his Invesco funds, has been in the Woodford Investment Management funds. Huge driver of outperformance in the last decade. Still a kind of 7% holding in the fund, but its share price has fallen 38%.
Yeah, I think the issue is, I mean, there's obviously a few individual problems. The overall issue is that it's invested in UK domestic facing companies, but then quite a few other funds have too. And have they not suffered as well?
This is really the key point for me. He isn't alone in taking this strategy, and as I mentioned before, but no one has done anywhere near as badly. So if we look at kind of the chart of his returns in mid-2017, his performance just tails off. The kind of FTSE All Share, the average for the IA sectors, they all kind of tally on experiencing volatility, and his just goes downwards. So since the referendum, only four funds have lost capital. He runs two of them, One is a kind of private mandate. He runs for a wealth manager, and then he's down 6%. The FTSE 250, which is full of kind of domestic stocks, small stocks, ones that we've talked about being undervalued, is up 21%. So you can see this is more than just him having an out of favour style. There's a material problem here as well.
Okay, but Mr. Woodford's had at least two other periods of underperformance because he is a contrarian investor and he does go against the herd. And guess what? He's bounced back very strongly when everybody's made the wrong call. So isn't this likely to happen again?
Always a chance, absolutely. Will not rule that out. And yeah, he is a contrarian investor and it's done so well for investors in the past, not taking away from his long-term record. The fact that he avoided tech in 2000, avoided banks in 2008, this is kind of the foundation of the long-term track record that we talk about when we talk about Neil Woodford. But yeah, so the question is now, is the weight worth the risk? That you have to factor in different things. He's wiped out his long-term track record in the last 3 years. He's in a completely different place in terms as a manager. He has much less support than he did at Invesco. There is an issue, and this has been talked about when people, kind of wealth managers and buy lists, have been dropping him, talking about whether he has anyone really questioning his investment decisions. And that is something which, you know, it's a very soft thing to discuss, but it's quite important. Do you have anyone challenging the opinions that you're making? You know, would he have made a large bet in Provident Financial had someone gone, hold on, this could go wrong? I mean, I'm just picking examples here, but it is a thing. There's also governance as well. We talked a couple of weeks ago, well, maybe 3 weeks ago, about the transfer of unlisted stocks from his equity income fund to his investment trust. Something he's been doing quite a lot because he's had to manage the amount of unlisted stocks he's allowed to have by the FCA in his equity income fund. Now, I can understand why he's done this and everyone can. It kind of makes sense. He has rules he has to follow. But when you start making investment decisions based on rules and based on kind of just making sure you reach a kind of arbitrary target, it doesn't sit well with me. Also, you have to really ask the question is, if he wasn't running the investment trust and he wasn't running the investment fund that was selling the assets to the trust, would this have happened? And the answer is probably no. There aren't two independent parties that would really engage in this kind of transaction for the reason that they engaged in. And that to me screams a really big governance problem. And that I don't think he would get away with that at any other firm other than his own firm. And again, that's something I think you really need to consider.
Jason, what do you think? Should investors stick with or ditch LF Woodford Equity Income Fund?
Sure. Well, I tend to agree with much of what Taha's just said and that criticism of the way the fund's been managed. And we took the fund off our buy list some while back, and I personally would not hold this fund. I think, look, you know, all fund managers will go through periods of poor performance. That happens to all fund managers, even the best. But I think if you look at those previous times he went through patches of poor performance, that was largely because he was not owning parts of the market that were in vogue and fashion because he felt that they were overvalued. Here, there are just numerous stocks have blown up. And, you know, my worry with the fund now is actually around the liquidity of it. And yes, Neil Wood has an immense fan club of people who've done very well from over the years. But perhaps people need to realise that this is a very different fund to the sorts of funds he was running in the past. You know, throughout most of his career, has been built on investing in large blue chip income generating companies and medium sized businesses. This fund now has very high exposure to early stage, small illiquid companies. A very high exposure to unquoted companies, and I just don't think an open-ended fund is the right place to be holding those sorts of stocks. But also a lot of AIM-listed companies that are tiny, where his positions will be very, very liquid. And my concern is the fund has already gone from 10 billion to 4.4 billion, so it shrunk quite dramatically. It's a really tough to manage an open-ended fund when you're having to cash out holdings to return money to investors on a regular basis. It's a really difficult environment for all UK managers at the moment because investors have now been consistently selling out of UK funds for the last 22 months on the trot. And I think, you know, the problem is the question that one must ask yourself now is actually, is he able to manage the fund as effectively as he might like to if he's constantly having to try and find cash to return to shareholders? And of course, you can't readily sell your illiquid holdings, and that may be one of the reasons why the number of listed companies, I think there are only about three FTSE 100 companies in the portfolio, has reduced so dramatically.
Okay, but are there any reasons as to why it might be a bad idea to sell his fund now?
Well, there's a lot of talk about he's had this contrarian view on the UK economy, and actually I tend to agree with that. I think UK shares are good value. But actually, if you look at the portfolio and the very high exposure to both unquoted companies, but also areas like biotech companies, it's not actually a given that there would be that those parts of the portfolio would benefit from a Brexit bounce, because your unquoted companies are not priced on a daily mark-to-market basis. The reason you might stay in is clearly some of these unquoted companies over time will hopefully IPO, and that's potentially when you will see the return realised on those companies. So there are certainly companies in there. Oxford Nanopore, I think, have just announced the intention to list in the next 12 months. So if these companies are as exciting and valuable as the manager believes they are, then obviously selling now, you may actually miss out on the upside of that. So that's the reason for hanging on in there. But it could get tougher before it gets better.
I mean, are there any other potential catalysts that could improve its performance?
There is quite a high exposure to UK house builders, so a rally in a sector like that would obviously benefit the fund. But again, I think you have to come back to the fact, well, the outlook's quite uncertain, both for the economy, but also we could have a change of government with a new government that's actually prepared to be quite a lot more interventionist in regulating areas like building and property. So to my mind, there's quite a lot of risk in this. It could bounce back really well if you do see these domestically facing parts of the market, you know, rally very strongly. And if you start to see the IPO window open up again and some of these unquoted companies get listed. So those are the sorts of circumstances where the fund could return to form. But I think, you know, above all, the question mark is, you know, when are the outflows going to stabilise? And all the while the performance is so tough, it's difficult to see that happening. And that is going to be a real headwind for the fund.
So if investors aren't particularly happy about investing in LF Woodford equity income, what other equity income funds could they consider instead?
Yeah, well, there are obviously the equity income sector, there's quite a number of, you know, attractive and well-managed funds out there. I think for a much more conventional fund that's a little bit more pragmatic in the way it's managed, Threadneedle UK Equity Income is a good core fund. TB Even Load Income is another fund that I like and is personally holding my eye. So it doesn't focus quite so much on the headline yield. It's looking for companies that can grow their yield. Or J.O. Hambro UK Equity Income would be another one to consider.
Okay, thank you, Jason. Some really good suggestions. And see this week's big theme in the fund section for our arguments and why you should stick with LF Woodford Equity Income. Another star manager who has built up a strong reputation is Alexander Darwell, manager of funds including Jupiter European. But earlier this week, asset manager Jupiter announced that Mr. Darwell will be stepping down as manager of this fund by the end of this year. Taha, why is Alexander Darwell stepping down from Jupiter European?
Most people are taking this as a kind of succession planning step towards retirement, which, again, when you look at it, is quite fair. So he's been running the Jupiter European Fund that you mentioned since 2001, has built up an incredibly loyal following, superb performance, joined Jupiter in 1995, and, you know, he's been investing in or kind of analysing European equity since 1987. So it's, you know, it's a fair time to perhaps think about trying something else. But yeah, so it's going to be part of a plan to see him kind of weaned off his popularity, I suppose.
Okay, now he runs a number of funds, so what's going to happen to the other ones?
Slightly mixed bag here. So the Jupiter European Fund, as you mentioned, he's stepping back from this year. Jupiter European Growth, which is the same strategy but is generally sold to non-UK clients, he'll be stepping back from that as well. However, he will be remaining as manager on the Jupiter European Opportunities Investment Trust. He's also going to be continuing to work for Jupiter and run kind of direct mandates for pension funds running the same strategy as well.
Okay, so big question. Who is going to run Jupiter European?
An interesting choice. It's kind of sparked some interesting debate. So the manager is called Mark Nichols. Listeners and readers might be familiar with him. He's co-manager of the Threadneedle European Select Fund. He's been there since 2016. It's another popular fund alongside the Jupiter option. He's ran the BMO Select European Equity Fund for 4 years, from 2011 to 2015. when we look at his performance since 2011, when he started running the European Equity Fund, he's kind of delivered, personally as a manager, he's delivered about 122%. That's versus 114% for the MSCI Europe ex UK index, and 120% for the sector average for the Investment Association Europe ex UK sector. So he's in line with kind of peers in the benchmark. However, when you look at Mr. Darwell's record over the same period, he's returned 205%. So you can see there's a bit of a gap there.
Okay, and what do fund analysts think about Alexander Darwell's forthcoming departure?
So the main sentiment is that there is no manager that could ever really fill Mr. Darwell's shoes. He is such a popular manager, delivered such excellent returns for investors. But other than that, it's generally quite positive. It's worth pointing out that Mr. Darwell and, well, the Jupiter Fund and the Threadneedle Fund operate on a very similar style. They both invest in large cap growth stocks. Some slight differences in sector and stock decisions, and some concentration as well. So Mr. Darwell takes a lot bigger bets on his favoured stocks, whereas the Threadneedle Fund, which is co-managed with David Dudding, they kind of make smaller bets on the same amount of companies, so it's a bit more equally weighted. The concentration and the bigger bets that Mr. Darwell makes is a big driver of the performance difference that I mentioned earlier. It is interesting because Mr. Nichols was expected to take full control of the Threadneedle Fund. He kind of joined Threadneedle in 2016, seen as a long-term replacement for David Dudding, another kind of excellent manager with a long-term track record. So kind of big problems for Threadneedle and that popular fund there. They've got a lot to think about. Also interesting because a lot of people probably would have preferred a longer handover between Mr. Darwell and Mr. Nichols. So Jupiter have said that Mr. Nichols will join this year. There'll be a transition period where they will work together, and then Mr. Darwell will step back. However, worth noting, as mentioned, that he is still going to be there. He's still going to be running other mandates and still will remain head of European growth at Jupiter as well.
Okay. Jason, do you think it's of concern that Alexander Darwell is no longer going to run Jupiter European?
Well, you know, he's had a fantastic track record. We actually own both the Threadneedle Fund and the Jupiter Fund. So where we're actually at on it at the moment is we've taken off the Jupiter Fund off our buy list pending a meeting with the company and the manager and the incoming manager. And I think that's sort of standard practice for us. So I think if you own the fund, there's no need to sort of rush out and do anything immediately, because there's going to be a handover period. You know, there are some similarities. So both managers have a sort of quality growth style bias to them. They're both around about 40 stock portfolios. But actually, then when you look at the stocks owned, actually there's not that much overlap. In top 10 holdings, I think there's three in common between the two funds. I think the other thing just to deliberate is, Mark Nichols started developing a very good track record at BMO. They were very hopeful about the prospects of being able to market him and grow that fund. He obviously went to Threadneedle in 2016 as part of their succession planning. It may be coincidence, but actually that period since has actually been a fairly weaker one for the performance of the Threadneedle Fund. It's actually underperformed 6 or 7% over that period. That may be coincidental. You never quite know when there are co-managers who's really making the decisions, or whether, you know, one is in practice taking the lead. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot, I think, to think about. There's undoubtedly, you know, Alex Darwell's track record has been stellar, and it would be hard to find a manager to replace him with quite the same track record. There are options out there. You know, one option could be to, for real fans of Alex Darwell, could be to switch to the investment trust that he's going to continue managing. I think that will be for a while. He's actually quite a significant personal shareholder in that trust. So, you know, his interests are certainly aligned with those of investors in that sense. So, you know, that could be an option. The trust is trading a very slight discount to net asset value. So that could be one option.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that investment trust is it's got an absolutely massive performance fee on it. So that added onto its ongoing charge takes up the annual charges to well over 2%. I mean, is it really worth paying over 2% for Alexander Darwell?
Well, obviously, you know, I'm not a big fan of performance fee structures, and that does, you're right, it does make the trust expensive in terms of its fees. The opposite argument, though, is, of course, is what matters is the return net of fees, and the return has been absolutely stunning on that trust. So, you know, I guess what it really depends on whether or not actually you're concerned about the charges in their own right, or actually, do you know what, sometimes it is worth paying a premium charges if the manager delivers the performance to merit it.
What would you say are the main arguments for sticking with Jupiter European?
Well, this is a, you know, it's a flagship product for Jupiter, and you know, the heat is on at Jupiter. Jupiter have got a lot of come under a fair bit of criticism. They've had some outflows. They've got a new CEO coming, so you know, within the business, there will be a real imperative to make sure that this is a success. As I say, you know, the last 3 years at Threadneedle has seen the performance on the European Select Fund a little bit disappointing, not disastrous in any sense, but a little bit more disappointing. But actually, Mark Nicholls, you know, in his own right, you know, was putting in some pretty good numbers at BMO. So clearly, the portfolio is unlikely to change overnight immediately. And obviously, Alex Darwell will be there in the background, heading up the team there for some while. So that's I think the argument for sticking in with it and you know, seeing how the handover goes.
Now, if let's say you invest are looking to put new money into a Europe fund and you're not already in there, should you still consider Jupiter European or just steer clear?
No, we've suspended it from our buy list for now. So I think if you were making a decision today, you were wanting to put your money in a European equity fund within your ISA by midnight, I'd probably be looking at funds like Crux European Special Situations, for example. Like, you know, that's got a veteran fund manager.
Mm. But is he about to retire too?
Well, no, I mean, I think, you know, he sort of...
That's Richard Pease.
Richard
Pease
is running that. You know, he only went there a few years ago. I think he'll be around for some time, yeah. That's probably jinxed me, though, saying
okay. All right. Thank you, Jason. Some great suggestions on Europe there. If you want some more suggestions on Europe funds other than Jupiter European, you can see the IC Top 100 Funds list online at investorschronicle.co.uk. Today marks the end of the current tax year and your opportunity to make use of annual tax-efficient allowances, such as individual savings accounts, ISAs for short, and pensions. But the good news is that with the beginning of a new tax year tomorrow, you've got a whole new round of tax allowances for the next 12 months. Now, Jason, investors can use allowances such as the ability to invest up to £20,000 into an ISA over 12 months. But why is an argument for investing your allowance in the first few weeks of a tax year rather than waiting until the last minute, next March or early April?
Look, it's human nature to leave things to the last minute, and on the last day of the previous tax year, the final ISA to be invested on the Best Invest website came in at 5 minutes to midnight. So you've had a whole year and you've left it to 5 minutes to midnight.
So you might get a few in today then.
Wearing a dodgy internet connection or anything could have lost that allowance for good. And I think, you know, naturally people think, phew, gosh, done that. Now I can forget about it for, you know, 10 or 11 months. But why not actually get out of that cliff edge pressure on yourself to beat the deadline and invest early in the year? And there's a very, very simple reason why you might consider doing that. One is it takes the pressure out of it. You can make a more informed decision. You can sit down, first of all, look at where your existing investments are, try and identify any gaps maybe in your asset allocation away a week, and then actually use the new investments to plug those holes and create a more balanced portfolio. That's just common sense. But I think the other reason for investing early in the tax year is, of course, in most years, markets rise. Didn't last year, but in most years, markets generate a positive return. And therefore, the earlier you're invested, the better, because you're going to enjoy many more months of return and, of course, tax savings. So that's another reason to do it early. Actually, I think a really, really good discipline, often seen as something just for the small investor, but actually for everyone, is why not just drip feed your money in throughout the year, whether that's on a regular savings scheme or, you know, investing in a series of lump sums throughout the year. It's a really, really good discipline for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it removes that the risks around getting your timing wrong. there's nothing worse than, you know, putting a £20,000 check into the market and then a week later the market's had some slide, and even though in the long run that shouldn't matter, investing regularly just helps you get a more average return across an average entry price across the year. I think the other reason for doing it on a monthly basis, it just removes the impact of emotional sentiment out of your decision making. At the moment, there are undoubtedly some of our clients who are thinking, oh, I don't know if it's a good time to invest. I'm worried about Brexit. I'm worried about the global economy. I'm worried about trade wars. Actually, if you just invest every month, automatically, on a standing order, it becomes as natural as cleaning your teeth in the morning. And that's what should really matter, is it keeps you going through the good times and the bad times, and actually just takes that kind of distraction of emotion and worrying about current events out of the equation.
Okay, and I guess it's if you don't have £20,000 to hand now, but you might you will with your paychecks over a year, it's a good way to
absolutely get cash flow wise, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, £20,000 is a lot of money. You know, or even if actually you invest on a regular basis what you can, and if you're someone perhaps who gets a year end bonus, you can always top up and use the rest of the allowance at the end of the tax year. But I think there's a really good case for drip feeding in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are there any other downsides to investing all your ISA allowance in one go at the start of a tax year?
I think that it just inevitably, at the end of the tax year, because it is that peak season for people making decisions, the advertising from, you know, fund management companies ramps up. Obviously, all the magazines and newspapers are talking about people's tips for the end of the tax year. And so it becomes very easy to get swayed by, you know, tips and marketing and advertising, but actually what you really need to do is first of all consider, well, where is my portfolio currently invested, where am I weak, where should I be topping up, and make a decision that's much more tailored to your circumstances rather than getting swayed by all the attention that investing gets in that sort of couple of months space.
Okay, now we've been talking about ISAs, but just thinking about other types of financial planning, are there any types of financial planning that, let's be honest, probably are better done at the start of the tax year?
Well, I think the one reason that people often leave things like their pensions and VCTs and other tax efficient investments to the end of the tax year is quite often people don't know how much they're going to be earning across the year, because, you know, for some people, a big part of their pay might be, you know, annual bonuses and the like. So they tend to sort of wait and get an idea of, you know, how much income tax they might be liable for across the year. But the same principle applies, is actually if you can invest regularly in your pension, you're getting that pound cost averaging, you're getting a more average entry price across the year, you're less exposed to sudden changes in the value of investment. So it still makes sense.
Okay. And I mean, is there any other circumstances where you definitely should leave it to the end of the year?
No, I think, for example, if you own investments such as shares or unit trusts that are outside of ISAs and pensions, as you know, that if you earn more than £2,000 in dividends from those, you will pay tax on them. Mm. So actually, if you own those, why not consider selling those within your capital gains tax allowance and then either repurchasing the same investment within an ISA, get your ISA done early, or buy some other investment within the ISA, because, you know, why sit there potentially paying tax on your dividends through the year?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Jason. Some really helpful tips. That brings us to the end of today's show, but see this week's Investors Chronicle of a website for more Neil Woodford and his funds, Jupiter European Fund, and investment suggestions for your ISA. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.